If you're going to re-examine gravity, quantum gravity, you're going to be faced with a number of horrible hurdles. The signature of the metric, as you well know, the metric is not something that runs from plus to minus infinity like the rest of our fields. We want the spatial part to be positive, for example, and the rest of it to do what it's supposed to do, so that's a complication. Constraints describe general relativity, and some of those can even be irregular constraints. I will clarify later in the talk what irregular actually means for your benefit. Anomalies arise in general relativity in the sense that first class classical constraints become second class quantum constraints. That's a complication for anybody's procedures. Famous non-renormalizability, perturbative non-renormalizability of general relativity. The absence of time and your favorite choice. Every time I see this list, I get very discouraged. So I have to give myself a little pep talk. And so I say, go for it. Let's talk now about the strategy I want to use. I'm going to re-examine the kinematical variables we use for quantum gravity, focusing on the metric positivity, that is the spatial metric in the ADM kind of formulation. So this is it's not strings, it's not loops, but it is a Hamiltonian and 3+1 kind of story. choose an initial representation without having the constraints imposed. This is what Dirac teaches us, because if we have a lot of constraints, imposing them classically may lead to a classical phase space, which is horrible in its geometry, and therefore quantization is quite ambiguous. We should quantize first and then impose the constraints classically. Quantum constraints, we have these anomalies to deal with, we have potential irregularities to deal with. So I want to introduce you at least, to the projection operator method, which I think is adequate to handle these things. Am I actually turned on here at this point? Okay. And finally, talk about the imposition of the constraints, and there I'll give you a functional integral representation which has a certain novelty into it, which was discussed in yesterday's talk at the university. So let's start at the beginning, talk about the kinematical variables and the metric positivity. The 3x3 matrix G for the spatial metric we want to take along with the pi, come in gentlemen, the pi upstairs, which are the canonical conjugate variables for the G in the ADM formulation. The G, of course, has to satisfy this positivity requirement that for any non-vanishing set of U's, this has to be a positive number everywhere. That's a very strong statement about what the G's can be, and we want to preserve that. If we took this literally and then promoted G to an operator and the pi's to an operator, then as you well know, pi acts to translate the G's, and that would tend to compromise this kind of criterion. So we want to find a conjugate set of variables for the G, which will enable this preservation to take place. And the result of how you do that is fairly simple. You want to lower one of the indices on this pi with the G itself, since it has this positive definite character. This is not any loss. You could always remove this and go back to the original pi by just using the inverse metric. So in the classical story, it doesn't matter whether you use the upstairs pi all themselves, the canonical pi, or this mixed index pi. You would be describing the same thing. But I want to emphasize the advantage of using this mixed index thing for the quantum theory. Okay, so we do that. And these become our basic variables here. There's 9 of these, because this is 3x3. There's no symmetry requirement. And there's 6 of these. They have a Poisson algebra classically, which I then promote to the operators. And here they are with little hats on, standing there. So the pi's satisfy this commutation relation here. 2 pi's make see another pi over here. A G and a pi come out with G's, and the 2 G's still commute as they did originally. So this is the form of the commutation relations that come when you promote G and pi as operators, pi with the mixed indices, and you take over the Poisson brackets straight into the quantum theory. This is a closed Lie algebra, as you can see. It's very different from the canonical algebra. It's much more like the current algebra over here, and so we'll have vastly different kinds of representations for that algebra. Indeed, if you choose to represent these operators as your basic operators and look for representations of those, then you are giving up a choice of a self-adjoint operator representation for the canonical momentum. Okay, so what is the advantage of these quantities? Let's build U of gamma, which puts an exponential of the pi operator smeared with a nice function, C number function gamma here. And we're going to take that gamma and exponentiate itself, divide by 2, and that makes a matrix MCA. Put this U on either side, U and U inverse, on the G operator. Can you see this bottom part here? Yes, I can't do anything about it anyway. And you'll find that that transforms the G bar, G hat rather, into another symbol, G hat here, with two matrices on its side. This looks very much like a traditional coordinate transformation. In any case, what it does, it takes a positive definite matrix as this was originally and gives it still a positive definite matrix. It preserves its signature. Your turn for a question.
You don't want to impose that when you raise the pi with the G, you get a symmetric thing? Are you actually increasing the number of degrees of freedom?
Well, I've put 6 into these here. I've put 6 of these here. I'm lucky to come down to 9 only.
No, but I mean, if you take the fundamental variables to be the G and the pi,
yes,
then you have extra degrees of freedom. You've introduced extra compared to what you would have done with 6 and 6. So you could get rid of that by saying, you know, inverting that relation and saying the result of applying, contracting the G with upstairs with the pi downstairs was symmetric. Just an algebraic condition.
It will become that later on. You'll see that. Yeah, it'll come again. And these gammas actually play a role of the dry binds that are so popular in quantum gravity and would be needed if I ever dealt with fermions. So they're not to be dismissed. Okay, so the whole point of this exercise is to introduce you to the affine commutation relations and the fact that they preserve a metric signature characteristics as we need it. Why are they called affine? Well, affine transformations in mathematics take straight lines into straight lines. And the pi's by themselves here form a representation of the general linear group in 3 dimensions. The G acts as a semi-direct product as a translation of that. So this whole thing together is an inhomogeneous general linear group, and that's abbreviated often to an affine transformation. Okay, so the next thing, we've now solved our choice of metric variables. We're going to choose an initial representation of these things without imposing any constraints yet. So we exponentiate both of these expressions, hoping to get them to be unitary operators in our representation. So we have a pi C number without the hat as a smearing function for a G hat, and the gamma smearing function for the pi hat as we had in the previous transparency. And we introduce a fiducial vector eta, and this family of vectors will depend on 2 C numbers, pi and G. G as a C number does not appear on the right-hand side, and you'll see it arising in a few minutes. But it's a substitute for this gamma, and it'll come back in a minute. And these, we'll call these the affine coherent states. As a restriction on eta, I'm going to immediately say that the expectation value of eta in eta of the pi hats should be 0. But I cannot do that for the g hat, because that's a positive definite operator. So that becomes what we'll call g tilde in this representation, and that is a metric of its own right. To flesh out what the rest of the story about eta is, I give you the full overlap between 2 different of these coherent states, and that's given by this expression here. E to the minus integral 2 b of x d3x. B of x is a representation parameter. It's a eta-dependent quantity, which is a scalar density lying between 0 and infinity. The rest of this expression involves the logarithm of the determinant of g tilde, double dot, the double prime rather, this variable, g prime, this variable, and then b inverse, which takes away the density character of these guys, pi double dash and pi prime, divided by some normalization factors. So what is this g, and where did it come from? Well, the gammas were originally here. The gammas then get folded into the matrix MCA. There's 9 of these, and there's 9 of these. There's nothing lost here. But what actually enters this final expression is a reduction of those 9 variables by this process here, m on each side of the g tilde. And we'll use that to define the metric itself, GAB. So that's where this g is. The answer depends totally on that g. It's like a symmetry that's built in here. Suppose these were the rotation operators, J1, 2, 3, that you're familiar with, and I had a rotation invariant state here. Then rotation of any amount would not change that rotationally invariant state, and so those variables wouldn't be there at all. So the fact that I've gone from 9 down to 6 variables of dependence, which are the g's, is a kind of a symmetry that's built into this quantity. This choice of vector is not absolutely arbitrary at all. It is the maximal weight vector for the representation of the affine algebra that we saw on the previous transparency. Anyway, here is the functional form of the overlap of these two coherent states, and that defines the representation of our operators. How can you say it defines the representation of the operators? Yes, sir.
Yeah, so I was just going to ask that. But let me ask in a different way. Have you defined somewhere else the inner product and then computed this, or is this a definition of the inner product?
Perfect question. It leads us into the next transparency, if I may, because I'm going to show you how this overlap here, this kernel, becomes the ingredient for a reproducing kernel Hilbert space. And that is where our representation is, and that is where our inner product is going to be defined. I remind you of the concept of reproducing kernel Hilbert space. Take a continuous function of positive type, k depending on two arguments, depending on some label space. Function of positive type has the property that the sum of am complex conjugate ans of klm, ln, from 1 up to a finite number should be non-negative for any n finite. And that has the property from the Gelfand-Neimark-Siegel theorem that such a function can be given as the representation of two abstract vectors, inner product of two abstract vectors in a Hilbert space. Take those abstract vectors and take linear combinations. They span the space. Take linear combinations. There's an element of a dense set here, another element of a dense set over on this side here. And I now want to make a functional Hilbert space representation from this machinery. Well, the only thing I know that spans the space are the set of vectors of these L's. We'll call them coherent states, for lack of a better term. So I take an inner product of those L's with that psi, and that gives me my functional representative for that particular vector. And this is how it's defined by just taking the inner product with here. It's a linear combination of this overlap function, which was our kernel that we had before. Similar for the other vector here, phi of L, and this is given this way. Now I'm left to define my inner product in my Hilbert space to complete the concept. So the inner product of psi and phi as functions, I will define to be the same inner product that they had in abstract vectors. You just take this guy, inner product with this guy, and you get this particular formula down here. So you can see that everything in this Hilbert space is built out of the overlap of the two sets of coherent states. There, the representation of the elements themselves, and the definition of the inner product with those guys themselves. Question?
So in order for the GNS number zero construction work, that space of continuous function of polytype should have a star algebra structure, right?
Fine.
Yeah, what is the, I mean, have you defined a product from that space?
I'm dealing purely with functions here.
Just, is that just like a standard algebra function?
Yes. Yes. Okay, so I will point at occasionally overlaps between various quantities and refer to them as reproducing kernels. This thing is actually called the reproducing kernel of the reproducing kernel Hilbert space. At the end of the talk, if there's a question why it's called that, I'll be happy to tell you. But for the moment, I'm just going to be pointing to those, and you can generalize on your own that the fact that there's an underlying Hilbert space that those things create. Quantum constraints. We're going to have a small lecture, sub-lecture in the middle here about the projection operator method to deal with quantum constraints. Each of you have your own favorite way to deal with quantum constraints, and I hope to introduce you to yet another one. Question? Sure.
So there was a condition, though. Are you claiming that that condition is automatic?
Which condition?
The positivity condition for any finite.
Sure.
You're saying that's automatic?
Well, the way I constructed the original coherent state overlap, which I did by computation, yes, that is automatically fulfilled because it comes in the Brocket form. So it's, by definition, going to be a positive function of positive time. It's just the norm.
I didn't show you the construction,
but I told you that's what it was. That's my choice of eta. I make a lattice approximation, see what I do for each degree of freedom, and then put it together, and then I take the continuum of it. Yeah. Okay, here's constraints, classical constraints. Let's talk about one or a few degrees of freedom. Phi alpha, a number of constraints, alpha 1 through capital A. Constraints classically should be 0. Dirac says you should quantize those first. Phi alpha, here's my quantum operators for those. And look for the subspace of the Hilbert space in which they act on and give me 0. Those are the elements of the physical subspace. For example, if I have two such vectors like this, I add the two vectors, I still get 0, so it's a linear space. And that's the subspace in which you should work. It's a fine idea, but I claim it has limited use. It's good for first-class constraints of compact groups, but for non-compact groups, it can be difficult. It can be difficult because you have operators whose 0 lies in the continuous spectrum, or so there would be no such vectors in the Hilbert space, or if you're ever dealing with second-class constraints, this is not going to be a good system. You can also obviously make that set of constraints into a single constraint by taking the sum of the squares. The sum of the squares being 0 tells you that every element of that thing should be 0. I could take the sum of the squares of these and replace that as Mr. Dirac would want me to do. That would have the same impact as this equation by itself, the many equations this represents. The projection operator method here, POM, projection operator method, involves a projection operator E onto the sum of the phi alpha squares, the thing we've just been talking about, not equal to 0, but with a spectral window, which lies, by definition, above 0 and above because of the squares, and smaller than some parameter, adjustable parameter, like a cutoff parameter, delta of h bar squared. That means it depends on h bar. It's not a delta function. It's just a small parameter that we can play with. Let me show you how that works. Let's take the rotation problem, where we have J1, J2, J3, and I want to project onto the spin 0, the angular momentum 0 situation. I say that's less than h bar squared over 2. Well, we know that's equal to h bar squared times L plus 1 or S plus 1, the spin values, and the least spin that would be non-zero would be a half, so that would be a half times 3/2, that's 3/4. This number is smaller than that, so the only spin value that's allowed here is S equals 0. So that projects on the right place. Let's look at this guy. I have two constraints, P, I squared, as the rule says, plus Q, I squared, P squared plus Q squared. That looks like a Hamiltonian, your harmonic oscillator. The lowest I want to put here is H bar. If I made it any less than that, I would have 0 in this story. This is an operator with a discrete spectrum that includes 0. That's a first class constraint. This is an operator which is discrete spectrum but does not include 0. That's a second class constraint. Look at this little graph on the side, idealized. The green curve here represents this first guy. As I come down and reduce delta, I can go all the way to zero and have a non-vanishing projection operator. I can reduce this delta here, this quantity, all the way to zero, and I would still project onto the zero space spin space. The blue curve over here is like the second guy, the second class system. I come down, I go down, and below a small delta, I get nothing. I've eliminated the projection operator altogether. So I come down, and below this number, I would have nothing left. The third example here involves a operator with a continuous spectrum, Q, just Q by itself. So Q squared is less than or equal to delta squared. This is in the continuum, so I don't need, I can re-specify it this way, less than delta or greater than minus delta. And clearly, this is like the red line. As I go down further and further, as I make delta smaller, I still have a projection operator here, but it is not yet projecting on delta equal to zero. As I go down further, if I go straight away to zero with this guy, it vanishes altogether. So I have to magnify, I have to rescale it. I'm looking really at the slope of this guy as it gets there. So I'm taking matrix elements of this, yes, we use pretend coherent states matrix elements, and divide by something which is also going to zero, the fiducial vector with the same projection operator, and then I can take the limit delta to zero. And what I get left over is a function of positive type of the variables in question, different function altogether, in which Q now is literally equal to zero in this story. And this serves to generate become a reproducing kernel for the Hilbert space of the physical Hilbert space. Okay, let's continue this little chapter. Suppose I have two constraints which are linearly dependent. In fact, I've chosen them two constraints which are identical, Q squared plus Q squared. That's called a reducible constraint situation. Well, in the projection operator method, you just play the same game, less than delta squared, take the same coherent states, divide by the same quantity, you come up with the same quantity at the end of the limit, whether you had two constraints here, one constraint, or 75 constraints there. This was reducible. This is irregular, where I have a larger power than that. Both of these are troublesome for many normal methods of imposing quantum constraints. Okay, let's make omega be power bigger than one. Again, I put it between the coherent states to take the divide by something, and I get the same expression as I get before. So it's insensitive to whether you dealt with a reducible or an irregular situation. Look at this case. I have a single constraint, so it comes in squared, but it vanishes linearly, hence squared when squared, vanishes linearly at Q equals zero and quadratically at Q equals one. This is a regular constraint here and an irregular constraint here. For delta small enough, that thing breaks into two projections, the sum of two projection operators, one near Q equal to zero and an orthogonal projection operator near Q equal one. As delta goes to zero, this goes vanishingly small, and I would have to divide it by something, likewise here, but the divisors would have to be different in each case in order to preserve it. So I use this, what I call an amplification factor here. I take, and here these would be coherent state labels like P and Q, except there wasn't enough room on the transparency. So I take the projection operator E0, divide by the appropriate thing for E0, take E1 matrix elements, divide by the appropriate thing for E1, integrate those together. That gives me a different weight factor under here than here, and then I can take the limit as delta goes to zero, and I get, again, a function of positive type for a reproducing kernel, which captures the contribution both of the Q equals zero and Q equals one story. I don't know of other systems which do that. Now, it's not so common that you would have two constraints which are identical, but they could arise. Look at this crazy system here. In the subspace where P3 squared plus Q3 squared equals H itself, then this term is zero, H bar rather, nothing there. So I would have Q1 squared and Q1 squared. I would have, in that subspace of the phase space, I would have a reducible constraint situation. But outside that subspace, I do not have that because these become linearly independent. In this situation, when this vanishes here, I have a single constraint. But when this is away from zero, I have two constraints, which are of the kind of a second-class constraint situation. Down here is a p vanishing linearly, becoming squared in this equation. So that's a regular constraint, and q vanishing like a square, so that's an irregular constraint. Nevertheless, you put them together, you get a second-class constraint, which again looks like another Hamiltonian. Adjust this quantity to be the lowest energy level, and you've got your projection operator. So all of those things can be handled. There's no gauge fixing. There's no Fadeyev-Popov determinants. There's no Grybov problems. There's no ghost. Yes, it can handle first-class closed or open systems, which is open exactly what gravity is. Second-class, reducible, irregular, not a sweat. Observables. Observables and the projection operator business should commute with the projection operator. If you want to take a general guy which doesn't quite obey that and you want to find its observable part, you just put an E on both sides of that. Coherent states have the advantage, which I assume most of you know, of their close connection between the quantum theory and the classical theory. You just take the diagonal coherent state matrix element of a certain generator, and that gives you the classical generator over here. Okay, yeah, H bar is still hanging around in the story, but if you want to take H bar to zero, then you recover with the normal classical guy in that situation. Similar story applies if there are constraints. So we have an E on the other side of both of the, to make this observable situation. Then I have to divide by an appropriate thing to fix the normalization, etc. So you can get a classical quantum connection even when there are constraints together. Not enough questions, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, suppose I deal with inf. Yeah, good, thank you.
What role does the operator ordering of constraints
Of an individual constraint?
Let's say with quantum gravity, we understand what the kinematic constraints are, the diffeomorphism constraints, but the Hamiltonian constraint, the many different operator orders.
Fine. I am faced with the same difficulty. I have to make a self-adjoint operator out of whatever I'm given. There are many ways to do that. I would choose one that experiment likes, whatever that experiment is going to be. That's no satisfactory answer, but that's a canonical answer.
Right. So, for example, supposing I choose one, so the constraints are first-class classically, or as you say, supposing I choose an operator ordering such that quantum mechanically they're no longer first-class.
Right, you're going to be forced to that with gravity. I live with that. I live with that. I live with the second class. I don't knock myself trying to get rid of it. I accept that fact. We're going to come to that. Okay. Maybe not so bluntly, but we will. Suppose I have infinitely many constraints. Suppose all the PMs are zero for, thank you very much, for an uncountable number. Then I would weight them with a weight which by itself adds up to unity, so that I have this story, and then I would again take my quotient and come up with a function of positive type. If I have constraints which are second-class constraints classically, they're going to become second-class quantum mechanically, again, I weight those. These are all baby little oscillators with a weight here. The sum of those up, setting it equal to h bar, will force this story into exactly that situation. If I have a field classically, like the Hamiltonian constraint in general relativity, I promote it to an operator, I would break it into pieces with an orthonormal set of functions, and then play a game similar to what I had up to there. Okay. So, questions, sure.
How do you know the result is independent of your choice of distribution state?
Independent of the choice of the fiducial vector?
Yeah.
The fiducial vector is a representation dependent story parameter. Take coherent states with e to the minus x squared, but I could have an omega factor and I could have a width factor in there. So each of those provides a proper representation of the Hilbert space, but it's omega dependent. It's a representation blemish, representation residue.
So what was the answer?
The answer is there's no physics in that. It's just whether you like to count in Roman numerals or in Arabic numerals?
I don't understand. You mean it's unitarily equivalent?
Sure, absolutely. Unitarily equivalent. Unitarily equivalent.
Maybe you should.
Well, for field theory, I choose eta, and I can actually go to inequivalent operator representations. Now, in that case, it's quite a different story. But if I make a modest change of the fiducial vector, so I stay in the same representation, yes, then it would be unitarily equivalent representation.
Representation of what? Of the original algebra?
Yes. The abstract operators are the same. They are unchanged. It's just that they represent.
There's a lot of technical issues. Representation. Usually you need a C-star algebra or something. You haven't given a C-star algebra structure yet. In order to do that, you may need a representation. Or you need
I'm talking about representation of Hilbert spaces. I have a realization.
You need a choice of basis.
I beg your pardon?
When you say representation, Hilbert space.
Schrodinger right, representation, the sequence representation.
Yeah, but are you? Well,
those are all unitarily equivalent. Momentum space representation, unitarily equivalent to the position space representation.
Right, so you're saying that you always get a unitarily equivalent.
Yes, yes.
Hilbert space, yes. No matter how you choose A.
That's right.
So I guess your question was like, how can you stay in the volume of that, right? Be sure that you don't go to.
Well, as I said, in the field case, you don't want to move eta too much, or you will have a manifestly inequivalent representation of the underlying operator algebra. Take the free field in relative.
We could. You haven't fully defined the operator algebra.
I did. I gave it to you in the beginning, and I gave you a representation when I gave you the coherent states. That determines a particular representation. Okay, so we were here, we were there. Now, I've sold you the projection operator. How do we make it? How do we get it? This is common to many stories. If I have a compact group, if I want to project onto the zero situation, I can make a group average using the invariant group coordinates here. Of course, I change the group I'm talking about, and I have to change the measure of that integration. If I have a non-compact group, that's not so easy. If I have operators which don't even form a group, then what do I do? Well, here is one universal rule which works for all of those situations. There's one measure here, R. It depends only on how many, constraints there are. It depends on delta, and it depends on the time interval, 0 to t, that you're integrating over. So this measure does all that. This is a time order integral here. These lambdas are like the Lagrange multipliers. The phis are the constraints themselves. As I say, this is an operator identity. It works for any phis. Take all the phis to be 0. Let them to be 0. So that's unity. This is 0 over here. Projection operator from 0 less than delta is everything. So that's the identity operator. That tells you that the integral over the measure R is unity. Unity. Remember your Fadeev-Popov story, which would want to use the flat measure here. And that measure has an infinite value. OK. So what we're doing is a different measure R. And if you're interested in the end, I'll tell you. This is a three-sentence story. I'll tell you right now. The R is a Gaussian, first off, in the lambdas to put all these together in one square sum at the beginning. Then there's a variance parameter left over in that Gaussian. Then I integrate that variance parameter with a sine x over x integral, which gives me a window on this side, a yes or a no, a 1 or a 0, which is exactly what the projection operator is.
So the variance is
delta? Delta is in here. It's in the sine x over x story, the coefficient of the sine x delta. Another question about that?
Same
question. OK. So we can use this expression in path integrals. For example, here's the path integral from sharp q to sharp q, living on the physical subspace, projecting with and evolving with the Hamiltonian that itself is in that space, and given by a formula of this kind. Formal formula, it needs to be defined, dp, dq, dr. Here is the C number representing these operators. There's the C number for the Hamiltonian. Of course, you have to go to a lattice thing to make that better defined. That's not so clear, not so perfect. So let me give you an alternative idea. If you love this, take it. Be my guest. But I'm going to try to educate you with something else. This is a continuous time regularization scheme in which you don't have to make a lattice definition. This is an alternative regularization scheme. I put inside my integrand an exponential e to the minus 1 over 2 nu p dot squared plus q dot squared dt, and then I take the limit nu to infinity outside, which formally sends this particular term to unity. Now, combining this term, p dot squared, with this measure and most of this normalization, q dot squared, with this one, most of that, I can make Wiener measure, p and q on the plane. Notice that this is dp squared plus dq squared. That's like a metric on a two-dimensional phase space. So I have Brownian measure on the two-dimensional plane, and the nu plays the role of the diffusion constant in that, so I'm taking the ultra-diffusive limit, and what's left over is a well-defined integral on paths, absolutely well-defined integral on paths. Okay, I'm going to give you the gravitational analog of this story. I'm not going to pass to the second line.
John?
Yep, question.
So a typical issue is, with gravity, maybe you're about to address it, is do you break the diffeomorphism invariants by the limiting procedures by which you define the path integral? So had you taken the root of a lattice, you would be vulnerable to the answer being, yes, diffeomorphism invariants has been broken by the lattice.
Right.
Here, there's an, I suppose the issue is diffeomorphism invariants broken in these added terms in the measure?
You'll see where that price comes in a few slides. Yep, okay. Your turn? Oh, no, God. That's, oh, Lord, what happened? Okay, let's try 11. So, more. Are we there yet?
So, I assume that. The question is where p prime and p double prime and q double prime here on the right hand side, are they boundary values for the?
Here? Yeah, these are boundary values. Well, just like in the q integration, your conventional path integral, you integrate over all paths holding the initial q and the final q fixed. You do that in this story, holding the initial paths, initial and final values of p and q together, and you automatically, by inserting this thing, you are led to, you can't avoid it, a coherent state representation. Further question? Okay, so this is just a reminder slide. Of course, we're going back to gravity now. Here's our coherent states. These are the coherent state overlap. And here we go. We're going to impose the constraints and have our functional integral representation. So this is a major formula with many different components. Here we're integrating over pi's and g's. That's like dp dq here, pi's and g's. The r is integration over the Lagrange multipliers. Here the na multiplies the diffeomorphism c number representative, n multiplies the Hamiltonian c number representative. We have a metric, the analog of the p dot squared plus q dot squared put in there. But here's the q dot squared, if you like. Here's the p dot squared, but I got all these bloody indices. I have to saturate those. This is not a choice on this. This is a direct consequence of the original functional form of this quantity without the e present. In fact, this formula includes without the e, because I say it works for any constraints. So set the HA and the H to be zero, so that term is dropped out. The integral of this thing is unity. So that formula then becomes the integral representation, a functional integral representation of the coherent state overlap. Okay, this metric is complete. Complete on the space in which the G lives in the positive definite form that I want. So the integration here is going to be restricted to and restricted by as well by the kind of measure that's in there. this term and this term, together with these, do indeed make a bona fide measure on classical phase space. Okay, anyway, that's that formula. Further issues I want to talk about. Well, there's only one of these we're going to have time for. That's always the case. And I'm going to stress the non-renormalizability in the hardcore interpretation. There's the time problem. Choose a gauge. That's my answer to that. Removal of cutoffs, that's the hard problem. We're nowhere near dealing with that. Yep, question.
Understand that the description of these things, you have to introduce gravity, you have to introduce ghosts.
Ghosts?
Well, you do calculations.
If you do it the old-fashioned way, yes.
PRST invariants.
Yes.
In order to do finally, if you end up doing, trying to calculate something like a cross section.
Okay.
So what happens here with this? Is you, why is you getting ghosts?
This is a ghost-free integral. There is nothing here that diverges. The integral over R is over a measure which is integral is 1, not infinity. If you have an integral which is infinity, then you may have to make some subtractions.
So when you calculate the scattering of which brackets on some, you always guarantee if you want to set
up. Well, this is still a preliminary. This is a preliminary stage of the calculation. Let's not rush to the end of scattering cross sections or anything like that. This is an ingredient that could be addressed by the traditional Feynman integral for quantum gravity, in which there would be divergences. This one does not have at this state of the game. Let me come to this other question, which is the non-renormalizability and the hardcore interpretation I'm going to give for it. because that will help address this question of what I do about non-renormalizability. Okay, so let me take you back to perturbation theory 101, which is a propagator in Euclidean representation of a harmonic oscillator and a potential here, V, a lambda is going to be positive, V can be positive as well. And here is the story when lambda goes to zero, lambda goes to zero, lambda goes to zero, this comes back to the free propagator associated with the harmonic oscillator. We all know that. We all believe that. That is a continuous perturbation in my language because the interacting theory is continuously connected to the free theory as lambda goes to zero. Examples of continuous perturbation theory are clearly V of x equal x to the fourth here, and you could make a perturbation analysis in that, and you'd have coefficients which were proportional to lambda, lambda squared, et cetera, and you could calculate all those, try to sum them, Borel sum, do whatever you like, and they would represent the interacting theory. And as lambda went to zero, it would go back to the initial theory. Even if this perturbation was super singular, let's call it, exponential of x to the fourth, so every time it came down out of the exponent and saw a Gaussian kind of ground states and things, excited states that this term would give you, it would give an infinite matrix elements. Nevertheless, even in that particular case, we still intuitively believe that although the perturbation theory has infinite coefficients all the time, as lambda went to zero with a regularized form, it would go back to the free theory. Indeed, that's the way many people view non-renormalizable theories, as those in which the perturbation theory is all lousy, but at least they are continuously connected. Does that depend on the fact that this has a discrete spectrum? Well, no, you can play the same game by throwing out the mass term here. And then, again, those things would go back to the free theory. And here's an analytic example. We can put in a perturbation which is a quadratic, so that's a harmonic oscillator. Here's the answer for the harmonic oscillator. Now, as lambda goes to zero, that thing literally goes back to the free particle with continuous spectrum. And that same story holds for x fourth and x to the minus x fourth. So that's perturbation theory 102. Now I want to introduce you to the course you never took, perturbation theory 499. This is the statement that there are quantum mechanical problems for which the limit as lambda goes to zero does not go back to the propagator for the free theory. I brought along my magnifying glass so that you can really see the not equals sign in this particular case. This is what I call discontinuous perturbation. I'll give you an example of that. X dot squared plus lambda divided by x to the fourth. Not multiplied by x to the fourth, but divided by x to the fourth. As lambda goes to zero, this does not go back to the free theory answer. It goes to this answer here. Why? Because the paths that would want to reach or cross x equal to zero in the original integral of the free particle encounter this divergence. For any finite lambda, lambda over x to the fourth integral is infinite for every one of those paths. And they are projected out of this expression for all positive lambda. So as lambda goes to zero, they will never return. And so what you get is something which restricts the paths to be to the right of that intersection or only to the left of that intersection. And that's what this propagator down here. So those are examples of discontinuous perturbations. You would be far doing the wrong thing to try to expand this in a power series and try to make sense out of this as perturbations of the free theory. That would be wrong. I could put an x minus pi here. X minus pi, see, here's a variation in which I have a different constant. X minus pi, I would do a power series in that, and the free theory is supposed to know about your singularity is going to happen at pi. Give me a break. It didn't happen. Okay, let's put this into pictorial form, schematic pictorial form. There is the free theory that we talked about, like the free particle. And I turn on a continuous perturbation. It will move out, and the coupling constant goes and into some part in this branch, and then come back towards zero to the free theory as the coupling constant goes to zero. Pseudo-free theory, that was the example on the bottom of the last transparency where we had a 1 over x to the fourth, we let lambda go to zero, and we did not go back to the free theory, we went to some other kind of free theory. If I start with the free in my imagination and turn on lambda over x to the fourth, I immediately jump to this branch. I go out as lambda increases, and then as lambda decreases, it goes back to this point here, the pseudo-free theory. That's the one it's continuously connected to, not this one. If you want to do a perturbation theory of that problem, you do it about this, including the effects of the hard core being that which projects out the paths that shouldn't be there. Now, I'm a great believer that this division between continuous and discontinuous carries over to field theory between what we call renormalizable and non-renormalizable theories. Renormalizable theories are those which are indeed continuously connected to the free theory. Turn them on and turn them off, it'll go back to the free theory. But a non-renormalizable theory involves a hard core, and I'm going to try to show that to you, so that you jump right up here, and you move out here, and then by continuity you go back to this point. If you want to do a perturbation theory of a non-renormalizable theory, you have to take into the hard core into account, and that's the thing you perturb about. Let me give you some examples of this. Idealized scalar models. I'm going to talk about two of those, and then I'm going to talk about the relativistic scalar field. So here is a simple model of a scalar field in which I've thrown away all the spatial gradients, spatial and time gradients. Here's another model in which I've just thrown away the spatial parts alone and left the time gradient. I'm going to talk mostly about this because it's simpler to deal with, but this goes along in a rather parallel way. Now I invite you, think of this as a mathematical exercise. Try to evaluate this functional integral. Okay, so, well, if you did it naively by putting it on a lattice here, and then took the limit as the lattice goes to zero of the what you see here, you would get a Gaussian answer. That's the central limit theorem, clear as a bell, at working here. You could also try a perturbation theory. Expand that out in perturbation theory and see what you would get. You get a perturbatively non-renormalizable theory because there's not even a 1 over p squared plus m squared in your propagator. It's just 1 over m squared. So this problem is Gaussian by central limit theorem, perturbatively non-renormalizable. Of course, those are the same story they tell you about the phi to the fourth theory, the relativistic phi to the fourth theory in five and more dimensions. And I want to draw a parallel to that later on. Keep in your mind, ladies and gentlemen, this quotient. The integral of phi to the fourth dnx 1/2 to the 1/2 power, divide by phi squared dnx. I take the 1/2 power so that I eliminate any simple rescalings that phi goes to 17 phi. That would cancel out in this quotient. This is less than or equal to infinity, clearly. That, all that means is that there are functions which are fourth power not integrable, giving me infinity there, where they are second power square integrable. They are, the bottom could be finite, the top infinite, so that quotient could be infinite. Okay, that's going to be a key. Let me review the central limit theorem argument for you a little bit. Okay, well, this is first step. We make a lattice approximation. So delta is our little elementary volume. We've broken up space-time into capital K cells. We're going to take K to infinity later on. We integrate over those. This is this first trivial model done this particular way. The next line has several modifications. First off, I recognize that the integrals are all independent. It's one kind of integral that I do. And so I can take the product of K outside the integral. Next thing I do is I change the variables. I let phi K times delta become U. It's just dummy variable, doesn't need the K anymore. And so I get a U squared delta inverse, et cetera, here. And I'm going to allow myself a counter term such as you typically get from perturbation theory, but I'm not going to derive mine by perturbation theory. I'm going to allow counter terms, and I'm going to say they're even functions because I don't want the, this problem was already had an even potential before. I want to preserve that. So it depends on U squared, it depends on the delta parameter. Okay, when H goes to zero, this thing is normalized, so it's unity. That means each of these integrals without that is really over a probability density. Expand this out, and I will get moments in that power density. So the first term, it gives me 1 because it's normalized. The second term gives me linear, but that's out because of symmetry left and right. And I get an h squared term and a u squared. This average means average in that particular probability density, 2 factorial. Then I do the fourth power, the sixth power, and so on. Okay, I want to take the limit k to infinity. That requires that the u squared be small. So when I take this, I get something finite. In fact, the u squared should be order delta in order that I get something reasonable out of that limit. And that can be done in 2 qualitatively different ways. Here is a picture of the probability distribution. One side, the other side is symmetric. It's the same. So here's a distribution of this underlying U probability, which looks something like that. That means it says if the width is of U squared is of order delta, that's that sign here, then by simple geometry, higher powers are going to be also smaller in width. So they get smaller and smaller. And that means that for this particular shape, I lead to an S of H with strictly Gaussian answer. And any nonlinearity here is wrapped up in the constant capital A. That's what the central limit theorem tells us. The other way you can do it is to have your distribution come down and have a long tail. This tail goes out to macroscopic values of U, but the area under that tail is proportional to delta itself. So when I find that happens, I find that the integrals of these, the moments of these things are all order delta. The first one order delta because of the width and the tail, but all the rest get nothing from this contribution. They get only from here because of the long low thing and the order delta. Okay, that leads to this kind of expression, which is a Poisson distribution. This is Gaussian distribution, that's a Poisson distribution. Those are the 2 kinds of things that happen. And W is a freely choosable quantity. OK, I can solve this problem. Here is the answer to this integral on self-consistent grounds. This is the W function, exponential of blah, 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 function here. And that's the 1 minus cosh minus 1 you saw on the previous transparency. What kind of counter term was required? I didn't invent it. It came out from the self-consistency. Then I went back and looked at what implied counterterm there was, and this is a natural logarithm of U. Natural logarithm of absolute U is the counterterm which makes that happen. Couldn't have guessed that at all. Okay, similar story works on the when I have a time derivative, but there's one extra feature worth commenting down here that I can talk about a classical limit of this theory because it has p's and q's and things like that. And the classical limit of this theory is equal to the original classical theory we started with. Okay, so now, one more time. Let's look at this guy and perturbation in lambda. We're going to perturb this. Lambda and lambda 0 are proportional to each other. So as lambda 0 goes to 0, lambda 0 vanishes. This thing vanishes, but I don't go back to a Gaussian thing. I go back to this one, which has the effect of the hard core. Moreover, let's do a perturbation in lambda. Perturbation in series of lambda, perfectly well-defined integrals, no divergence whatsoever. Okay. What about the scalar theory? I put all the space-time derivatives back in. Here it is. I've done it here in three dimensions, a super-renormalizable case. I've done it in five dimensions. This is the implied non-renormalizable case. I'm looking at the limit lambda to 0. Here I expect it to go to the free theory. Here I expect it to go to the pseudo-free theory, which I represent in this way by introducing a projection operator, chi, which says, yes, some fields are allowed, some fields are not allowed because they were pressured out by the fact that this lambda phi to the fourth dominates over that. So is that a truism? Is that true that it dominates? And the answer is yes. Here is the story one more time. Here is the Sobolev-like inequality that's of interest to me. You saw it previously alluded to when we didn't have any derivatives there. Now I show it to you when the derivatives are present. This is the phi to the fourth interaction raised to a half power. This is the free action right down here. And you question yourself, what is the bound on that ratio? It can be shown that if you are in n less than or equal to four dimensions, that's the renormalizable case. That bound is finite, and 4/3 will do the trick just nicely. Whenever you're in n greater than or equal to 5, the non-renormalized situation, that C is infinity. Meaning, there are fields for which this term is infinity, and that term is finite, leading me to the infinity. Okay, question. Hello? Lambda phi to the fifth, sixth. No, in four dimensions, you're saying? Yeah, I agree. Okay. Up until, I've given this talk several times before, but this is the first time that I've been able to say the following sentence. 2 weeks ago, I put on an archive publication which, in my opinion, addresses the true hard core of this scalar, relativistic scalar field, and shows that I can develop a divergence-free perturbation theory for these non-renormalizable models. I would say that sentence again. Divergence-free perturbation theory for these non-renormalizable models, just as we saw on the previous transparency for the toy model without any derivatives at all. I now claim I can do that for the relativistic situation, and not only for phi to the fourth in five dimensions, but phi to the sixth in four dimensions, phi to the 28 in three dimensions, whatever you like. It all works. Sure. That's right. That's why you view it the traditional way, but not that way. Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Okay, I'm ready to summarize. Time is nearly up. Okay, our goal started out to preserve metric positivity at all costs. We wanted to choose kinematical variables which respected that G has to have special spectral properties. And the affine kinematical variables were the guys that said that. The gravitational anomaly, first class classical, becomes partially second class quantum mechanically. Projection operator method doesn't care whether it's dealing with first class or second class. It does it, but in both in a unified way. So I can admit the anomaly and swallow it. functional integral formulation. Yes, we can make lattices, etc. But if you adopt this continuous time formulation, I owed you something about that. I'll come back to that. Continuous time regularization, you can vastly improve that formulation. And the non-renormalizable theory and the bold claims I am making today, 2 weeks after, is that the hardcore interaction will clarify that in a great way. Thank you very much for your attention. Sure.
This all went by pretty fast, but it seems to me that you were saying that...
I'm sure I was.
That if we did the right perturbation treatment of gravity and then took away the interaction, whatever you identified as the interaction, you'll go back to some other theory.
Yes, yes.
Than the Gaussian theory.
Yes.
What is that classical theory that we go back
to? Let's talk a little bit about the free theory, the Gaussian theory of gravity. Gaussian theory, I would take, and correct me if I'm wrong, I would take the linearized gravity and integrate. What is the range of the variables in that integral? I have things representing the linearized g delta plus h. What are the range of the variables of the h?
Which
h? Well, I'll put the question more bluntly. Am I preserving the signature of the metric or am I not in that integral?
You are not.
You are not. So linearized. What?
If you think of the H as a genuinely finite perturbation, then of course it will destroy the signature when it's larger.
Thank you. So linearized gravity is not, in my judgment, gravity. It's a different theory. And the example of the hardcore is, at least I've got to rectify your inclusion of the wrong parts of the H with my demand that it have the right spec. That's a hardcore statement right there.
So was that the answer to my question? Is it the theory that you come back to? Is there a different classical theory that you come back to?
It has a hardcore potential, but I don't know fully what the hardcore potential looks like yet. I'm claiming in the five of the four theories, I know what it looks like now.
Lambda phi to the fifth.
You like the odd powers?
Six.
Thank you.
One.
I am prepared, ladies and gentlemen, I am prepared to give you the answer to what I think the right regularization of this phi to the fourth special relativity. I'm also prepared to give you a 20-minute PowerPoint presentation on that if you had any interest.
Because this is an exercise, you just do it.
No.
And you should be able to use your math and exactly see what happens. So when you're going to, it should take me 20 minutes to.
You are making very strong assumptions in what you're saying. And I am.
No, I think you're agreeing. He says he can do it, and he's only one time, and follow the method. And he can make sense of.
Thank you. That's exactly what I said. One counter term, and I can make sense of everything. Yes, I know. It's bizarre. I'm wanting to have to expose this for criticism.
Can you write down the counter term in less than 20 minutes?
Sure. May I show it to you on a screen? Okay. Okay, so have we finished this talk yet? Let's see.
Yeah.
Another question, sure. Let's do that.
Let's do this. This seems to be important.
Another question. I owed you a question, so I haven't
got. No. Let's
do the other?
Because if you
Okay, you ready?
That makes sense of lambda 5 to the 6, it becomes more provocative.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Okay, here we go. Okay, so this is a short talk I'm hoping to give in England in the summer. That's your, okay, do you want to go straight to the answer?
Yes.
All right. There it is, right there. There's an inverse square term with a certain coefficient. I won't even be able to tell you what the coefficients mean because you went straight to the answer. But that's the answer. Here is your kinetic term, there's your mass term, that's your phi to the fourth term, and here is your counter term, phi to the minus 2. This is nothing more than a certain factor ordering, a cleverly chosen factor ordering ambiguity available in the original theory. You say, how the hell could that come about from a factor ordering problem?
So you're looking at phi to the fourth in higher dimensions.
Yes, higher dimensions, high dimensions. This accounts for.
It's equivalent to the amount of phi to the fourth.
What?
Or non-theorized theory, it's what happens if you do the amount of phi to the fourth.
6, 40, 400, whatever you like.
6.
Anything, put it there, anything.
Any polynomial.
And it's the same counter term. But you won't let me give you the 4 or 5 slides which precede this. So. Hello?
The same counter term.
Yes.
What is the phi k? Is this
What's
the phi sub k?
Phi sub k. K is a lattice point. K is a set of integers. It's a street address of the lattice points. A to the n, A is the lattice spacing. This is your derivative term. This symbolizes boom, boom, boom in the different directions. F is a certain number.
Is this the same thing as having in the propagator 1 over p squared plus 1 over phi squared?
1 over p squared plus what?
1 over phi squared in the propagator.
How could that be?
Sorry,
the propagator is. No, say it again.
Forget
yes, I agree.
The problem is that if you do lambda 5 to the 6, you start getting long powers of p squared. So that gets you into trouble. So how can you get rid of it? I don't understand.
Right. I'm being forbidden from telling you the story, but I.
Maybe you can have like a short platform discussion.
Well, or I could continue for the select people who care. They'll hear
about this particular issue.
I'm told you sometimes go to an hour and a half, and this will fit in with that window.
Okay, so it's not, is there any other questions? Not
this is a really short question.
Sure. No, but.
Yes, sure, yes.
One of the very first conditions that you described was the metric positivity, specifically. This spatial part. And so the condition itself isn't the Lorentz invariant, but you've done an ADM formalism.
Yes.
And you separate out time and space.
Yes.
What about something like the Schwarzschild geometry? If you were to quantize that, when you get close to r equals 2m, what happens to your metric positivity condition when the spatial metric actually passes through the horizon and r and t flip?
Well, I always thought you just. Switch the meaning of R and T.
But you've sort of brought in your metric positivity at the level of quantum mechanics. And so what happens quantum mechanically when we cross the event horizon? It seems like that crossing is forbidden because of your condition. So I don't really understand why you...
That's a coordinate mischoice, as I understand it, namely as the coefficient of the R changes sign, the coefficient of the t changes sign, why wouldn't I just simultaneously change what I mean by r and t, and so I haven't done anything wrong. Yeah. Okay, so you're all excused except those who want to know the future.
There's one more question. By
you've been explaining the discontinuous perturbation at first in a simple quantum mechanical problem.
Yes.
And we saw there that when you have, let's say, a free particle of quantum like that, with an additional potential of the type lambda over q to the fourth, for example.
Yes.
then we saw that certain paths were forbidden.
Yes.
As long as lambda is finite, those paths are forbidden.
Yes.
Those that pass to zero because of the singularity.
Yes.
So when we saw it that when lambda goes to zero, then we always have, for all finite lambda, a theory in which the path integration has to be restricted to paths.
Say it again.
The path integration has to be restricted to paths that do not cross the zero.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Okay, so we obtain, therefore, in the limit, a theory that is somewhat different from what you would have had if you had said lambda equal to zero. Right?
Yes, yes.
I'm wondering now, if we do that in quantum field theory,
yes,
then there must be a similar sort of statement. We must be able to say that the theory that we arrive at as lambda goes to zero is basically pretty much like the theory that I'm wondering which things are there. Is it what you are mentioning that the integral of pi to the 4th is completely divergent to the integral of pi squared is not? Is that basically telling us which of the field configurations are forbidden down in pi?
Yes. Here is, if for n greater than or equal to 5, there are solutions to this, where this integral is finite and this integral is infinite. For 4 and less, there are no such solutions. Let me draw in here the class of all fields, phi, which obey this rule. Any phi which is here in which this has happened has to have a singularity. So that phi is like 1 over x to the, can that be seen? Maybe I should go a little over here. Phi like 1 over x to the gamma to take care of the singularity, and this takes care of infinity. And if gamma lies between n over 2 minus 1 greater than n over 4. So an n with 5, that's 1.25. Over here, 5 is 2, is 5 halves, take away 1 is 3 halves, 1.5. So there are some gammas for n equal 5 for which this field is true. But you don't talk about those kind of things in your classical solution. You talk about smooth initial conditions going smoothly. So these are fields out on the boundary which are being excluded in the theory when you go to the classical limit. So you don't, sorry, classical limit. When you, yeah, okay, classical limit. When you go to the theory which has the hard course, you wouldn't encounter them in your classical story. And you want a Lagrangian here and you want to talk about smooth fields and blah, blah, blah.
In a naive fashion has some translation invariance and other nice properties. You know, the usual method for completing the squares in the exponent to end up with a family. Is there a way to modify that, to take into account that some of the fields are not forbidden, so that we then arrive at modified Feynman rules that would take into account the hardcore?
Well, the Feynman rules make great use of the Fourier space. That's not going to be available to us here. And I like to think of this is a quadratic problem in which I can't go in certain directions. Because even the smallest value of this is going to give me trouble already. So there are certain directions in the plane of a quadratic path integral that are disallowed. Well, I don't know how to do that path integral. So I'm fumbling with this other method.
Following up in a sense, if you look at the proof why lambda phi to the 4, I mean, even in 4 dimensions, lambda phi to the 4 is supposed to be a trivial theory.
Yeah.
It's perturbatively renormalizable, but it's supposed,
yeah,
said to be trivial.
Right.
One way.
I'm salivating on that, baby. Yes?
Well, so you probably know the question. So if you put, so you have a modified version,
right? Yes.
With, I guess, the same counter term.
Yes.
So if you go and put that on a lattice.
Yes.
What do you
find? I'm eager to try to do it. I first want to do it in 5 dimensions.
What about
come on. I want the proof of principle in 5 dimensions. Because in 4 dimensions, it will be logarithmically difficult. In 5 dimensions, at least it'll have a power. So things should show up quicker in 5 dimensions. So you know, there are some arguments in this discussion of plausibility and estimation, and I want to do that Monte Carlo-wise in 5 dimensions first. and then show that it doesn't go free like other people want to say. Gallavati. Gallavati has done many different renormalization group studies with the phi to the four, I guess in four dimensions, and has never come up with anything that gave him a non-free answer. So yes, I agree. I would love to try the phi to the fourth form if I get proof of principle in the five dimensions. But heck, why not? Go for four too, right straight away.
Thank you. So let's thank our speaker again.